Okay, so if you can just introduce yourself, where you're from, your name and where you're from, I'd be...
Chesky Bramwitz.
From? Okay. Where did you go to high school, TA?
TA, yeah. So I have a hard time believing in Kabbalah, because it just sounds stupid. So I want to know your thoughts on it.
You want you to wave a wand and you should disappear? You're kind of that.
Preferably him, but.
is that kino? Is that a? Okay. So let's. So.
What's the word?
Okay. Unfortunately, what you don't believe in is probably not Kabbalah. Kabbalah, in a folk's way, has become the study of magic. How to do all sorts of neat tricks, and Kabbalists do all sorts of tricks. Whatever that is, it is either not Kabbalah or it's a very ancillary part of it. And Kabbalah is an understanding of the Ribbono Shel'olam's ways of dealing with the world in a very abstract way. If I can give a mashal, it's what mathematics is to physics, that's what Kabbalah is to Torah. Mathematics strips away the particular details and it tells me that if something increases its velocity in such and such a way, these are the results. Whether we're talking about a person going in a spaceship or we're talking about money producing interest, it's the same formula. The natural log E, natural exponent E, stands for anything. For infinite compound interest, for bacteria, uninhibited bacteria producing, and the reason is because it's a more abstract way. So mathematics has an advantage, it's more abstract and fits many more things. It has a disadvantage, you know what you're talking about. Kabbalah is the understanding of the Drachma HaKadosh Baruch Hu, stripped of details and just understanding abstract mahalchim. It's a complex and difficult for many reasons. One of them is that we have a very hard time dealing with things that are totally abstract, and that's why if we open up a Kabbalah sefer, we're clueless about what it is. Kabbalah requires that you speak about things and not really know nothing physical, and that's why it was meant to only for people big time chachamim, and they have the ability to understand. It also requires Talmud and Kedusha. That's Kabbalah. Look at the Sefer Arizal, look at the Zohar, but the Sefer Arizal is the core of Kabbalah. Did people do tricks and things like that? There was something called Kabbalah Mysis, stories about it. You can believe it, you cannot believe it. It's irrelevant. The Kabbalah that we have a Masoris on, going back a very long time ago, is a certain type of vocabulary and structure of understanding Dark Hashem in a very abstract way. The other stuff that you read about, some of it is just stories, and some of it might be true, but for whatever reason.
So, two things. One, yeah. To get your definition down, it's kind of like how the world works, but
yes.
Like saying the bare bones formulas for how everything runs. So you don't, it's not really, it's more of a, I guess, conceptual way of...
Correct. Now, it is a conceptual way of understanding HaKadosh Baruch Hu's drachim in interacting with the world. Correct.
Okay. And then, but that, my problem with it is not so much like the stories like that, but it's like when people say, if you scratch your hair, you'll forget your Torah and stuff like that. Like, to me, that's...
So, this is something else. This is called skula. The Gemara mentions a few things. Our personal service in Yeshivas is things that the Gemara mentions. A skula means it exists for a reason that's not physical, and we have no understanding why. That's almost the word skula almost means that. Our Masoris in Yeshivas says things that the Gemara mentions, those things are absolute. And we take it, whether we understand or not. Anything that's not mentioned in Gemara, we in Yeshivas, we tend very strongly to stay away from it, shy away from it. So things that I mentioned, many things people have all sorts of tales that come in from Goyish sources, from fairy tales. And that's why I would be... my Masoros is very Litvish, so stay away from those things. If Chazal said it, Chazal said it. But very, now, scratching your head, the only thing that it says is you have to wash water, because that's the covet of Torah. A real scratching people's heads are filthy, you know, they've got whatever it is, and it's not the cover to sit and learn or daven when your hands are dirty. That's all it is. There are a handful of things that the Gemara does mention, and we stick to it because the Gemara mentions it. It's not Kabbalah, it's a skula. That's a Gemara, yes. But again, whether what it means, why it is, how it is, we take it because if Chazal said it, they knew what they're talking about. But anything that does not have a clear makor of extremely reliable things, we our Masoros was to stay away from it because so much superstition has come into it that it's Avodah Zorah, not Torah. What's your name?
Chanoch Sanzer.
Chanoch?
Sanzer.
From where?
Muncie.
There's a Sanzer family in Silver Spring, related?
Yeah.
That's your grandparents? Your cousins?
My uncles.
Okay, very nice, yeah.
So what about, let's say, walking over someone or, let's say, hunting your
It name? Doesn't say, okay, walking like over somebody does not say any place that I know of, and therefore...
You're not allowed to grow, you won't grow anymore, like, for example, like, I heard
so
that.
So I believe it's an old wives' tale, and I believe, and I believe a person should not... I have a mechutin in Toronto, he lives in the cold days, older person, and he's made it almost a life's hobby to debunk all sorts of things that have no makoros. And he sends out an email almost every day, you know, and he, what?
Mythbusters.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. And it's very, it's important the Rashba writes in a tshuva that, you know, it says that Moshe Rabbeinu asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he said, Chazal can believe me, Chazal can believe me. And the Rashba writes in his tshuva, it is a mile of Klal Yisrael that they only believe things that they have from their avos b'mesoros. And anytime somebody comes along and says, wow, I've got this great thing going, you greet him with a lot of suspicion until he proves himself. A Navi has to prove himself. Coming along and saying, I am a great Navi, is not where it comes. You have to prove yourself. So those things that have a mesoros on are, you know, are carved in stone. Anything else, one should not get involved in it.
Mm-hmm. I'll keep scratching my head.
So Rel, let's say someone
maybe walks, scratch his head, so you'll figure out who's.
So Rel, walking, let's say the toenails. Is that right?
Toenails is a Gemara about again. Whatever the Gemara says is a Masoros to us, and that's what it is. But it says also that so you're not allowed to leave it laying around. If you move it or whatever, go through the Gemara. We stick to what it says because Chazal said it. Chazal knew what they're talking about.
And what Gemara it's in?
What?
And what Gemara it's in?
I don't remember offhand. It says Chassid is a Seref. It's not hard to find, but
next one.
I don't remember. Yes.
Yechiel Brook from Brooklyn. Yeah. If you had to give like one tip to like take a. You're working on a Muna to like another level, what would you say?
There's a pasuk that says, Su'u marim enechem, lift up your eyes heavenwards, Uru'u mibara el, and see who created all of these. So people interpret this pasuk loosely, that just take a look at astronomy and so on and so forth, and wonderful. I had a little bit of a different emphasis in the pasuk. The first half of the pasuk is Se'u marim enechem. Pick up your head. In other words, the first thing, the mood of a person looking for a moon has to be, you're sitting back and you begin to think. You're in a mood that's more serious, mood that, and you ask yourself, in such an extraordinary world, who am I? What am I? Where did it all come from? Part of the Chazanish in Amunah Bitachon, when he sketches searching for Amunah, he starts with in the middle of a dark night, a person who's very sensitive is thinking and his head is spinning with everything that's around him and trying desperately to get to the heart of the mystery of who, what, and so on. A lot of Amunah has to be it has to be when you're in a contemplative mood, in a serious mood, and we don't have a lot of that. You know, how much time has anybody ever spent sitting quietly themselves in a sort of undisturbed atmosphere and being seriously asking himself, does my existence have any meaning? If I would not be here, would the world be missing anything? if all of us would not be here. There's an article in New York Times 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago maybe, before I came here. Is the world better off without people? I kid you not, this was a major an op-ed, because since we basically destroy everything in the world, whereas the chipmunks and the fish and the turtles, they all sort of feed the ecology well, and we disrupt the ecology. So maybe the world would be a better place without people. That was the Shiloh put down, the contemplation. But let a person ask himself, as a human, what does it mean that I'm human and different? That to kill a person is the most horrible thing to do, and to kill a cat, a dog, a sheep, even a monkey is fine, is okay. It's certainly not nothing like killing. Why? What am I? What about me makes me different animal? Let a person contemplate and think about these things. I think the mood and the seriousness that one addresses it has a lot to do with getting a firmer grip on it. Yes. What's your name?
Yeah, Goldstein from Cleveland.
You're Goldstein from Cleveland, yeah.
What? kind of going off from what you should have said. I personally haven't had struggles with like moonshoots and things like that. I pretty much understand that like God created the world and we're, you know. But when it comes to like things like afterlife and reward and punishment and all those like the typical questions. Like I try not to like ask questions. I try not to like hear the other side really, because I just like it's too complicated for me. Is that something like should you learn about it so you can answer, or is it something that like if you're fine without really knowing, you just like keep floating?
So, if you ask, when you say to learn about it, we really need to ask ourselves, what are we going to learn about it? To describe Olam Gehenim and Gan Eden, there are no descriptions for it. Whatever descriptions you give are irrelevant. It's a conceptual thing. It's abstract. It's nothing. When you talk about rivers and you talk about this or that, you're not a physical being there. So learning about it, if that's what you mean, is not gonna do it for you. Proving it with proofs. They're not going to be the type of proofs where, you know, the way you can prove creation and so on. But when a person looks into self and thinks about what a human being, imagine, let's think a minute. If let's say we hear that somebody got away with tremendous, tremendous crimes he did, we really feel that this can't be. Something in us tells us this can't be. And what is that feeling? Where coming from? HaKadosh Baruch Hu endowed us with a vague sense of emes, where we say to ourselves, it can't be that so-and-so killed so many people, so-and-so made so many people miserable, and nothing, he's gone off to his grave and that's the end of it. We do feel very strongly that there's justice, and there has to be Yeshdim Yeshdayim. Those feelings come from somewhere. I once asked somebody, he was a boy, 18, 19, it was my house many years ago. And he doesn't believe in anything, so on and so forth, but he was extremely idealistic. He came from vaguely from family, was idealistic. And this was when apartheid was still the policy in South Africa. So I asked him, would you go to South, and he spoke about it constantly. I said, Sam, I think his name was, would you go to South Africa and sacrifice your life to bring down apartheid? He said, absolutely. I said, what's the logic of that? Why should you give up your life for somebody else to live? My chazis the domo sumak tfei. Like, I don't say something. Maybe, the question is, he die and you live, or you die and he live? How do you decide you're going to die, he should live? So he said, because I could live many lives with my one life. So I said, okay, I've got a better way for you to go. Check yourself into a hospital and have them operate on you. Take out one heart, two lungs, liver gets chopped into many pieces, pardon the pun, two kidneys, and a lot of other stuff. You can save a dozen people with your body. Why don't you do that? So he didn't. So I said, I'll tell you why. You're not measuring your life with other people's life. You don't like injustice. And something about injustice not being able to survive and wanting to topple it is in your blood. Where does that come from? The concept of justice and injustice. It's not a physical concept. It's something wrong and right is so deeply embedded in you that you won't sacrifice life for it. Those feelings are coming from a good place, and that's where it's coming from. The sense that we have justice, you know, a little kid, you know, when somebody takes a toy from them, they take it back. So that makes sense. But if let's say the other person grabs the candy and swallows it, you can't take it back anymore. You instead substitute giving the kid a patch. That's like kind of, you know, and the sense of it is to even out the score. That it can't be that this person has won more candy unjustly than I have. So at least if I give him a patch on to the ground, somehow justice has righted it again. We have those deep feelings. If a person is misboning on it, if a person is misboning on his own self and understands he wishes to perfect himself as much as he can here, but he hopes that for eternity there's some way for him to perfect himself. Every single person is geared to respond to reality in a real way. And yet, nobody wants to die. Nobody is interested in dying. Everyone resists dying. And the reason is, well, but that's unrealistic. Why would we resist it? The answer is because down deep we're programmed to live, not to die. And the life force in us is eternal. So those are the types of things that a person could think about and begin to get a feel for the concept of it. Because the details, there are chazal about it, but those they're all abstract. They're all are concepts. And you're not going to get anything from that.
Free choice is more, things that like more of an example, things like free choice and things like that, that like when you, for seeming contradictions in the Torah and things like that, like where there are answers, if you
yes.
learn everything in and out, is it important to go through the whole...
So the answer is as follows. In a general sense, that's part of the Rambam's, like Yisodia Torah, Sefer Amada. Those are important understandings of how we understand these things. These are fundamental concepts. So in a basic way, the answer is yes. In a more detailed way, it depends on you and your personal needs. There's also one more thing to remember that I think is very important in this area. In the realm of ideas, there's no absolute proofs and absolute disproofs. People who tell you, the Ramban says this about Torah, that there's no mofis choter. You cannot, there hasn't been a philosophic proof that hasn't been disproven, and a philosophic disproof that hasn't been disproven. It's ideas, and not every idea that sits well with one person is with another person. So if you're hoping to get the answer, then you're chasing a wind. But if you're hoping to get ideas and concepts that slowly, slowly begin to help you form a picture that's going to stay with you, the answer is yes. So first of all, never look for the answer, because that doesn't exist, and you're looking for failure. No argument. The only place where absolute answers exist is mathematics. Even science, you know, there's a picture of how we think. I learned in high school, the books I had in high school for chemistry and physics are today outdated. And the atom doesn't look like that at all. It was Terence Emerson when I was learning it, and it's a dinosaur today. So math is the only thing they haven't changed the answers since I remember, and they're not going to change. But everything else, and especially the world of ideas, but building a picture by being misboning on different things for a person who needs it is a very important part of it.
Well, it says in Davin by Kiyat HaShemek Tefillah by Avraham Rachman, it says there's a special prayer that you can ask.
We say Shema Kolein. Yeah. Yes, I am.
So it says a special prayer. So So the discussion with the Rebbe about it, like, does it actually help? So he said there was a, I'm not sure which Rebbe exactly said, you shouldn't say anything during your Shemoneh Esrei. It should just be davening itself. Why does he hold of that? Curious. And what's it?
I don't know. You're quoting someone else. I don't know. I don't know where the person's coming from. Mm-hmm. There were different approaches to it. On the one hand, you can daven a special your miyuchadik tefillos. On the other hand, there's a problem sometimes, since we relate so much better to our personal tefillos, that don't get into the feeling of what Chazal wanted in the general tefillos. For us, Rifa'einu and Baruch Aleinu are basically the core issues, and Shema Koleinu for maybe Shidduch, and that's it. What about Yerushalayim Ircha, Ashiv HaShevteinu, etc., etc.? So, Shmoneh Esrei is not meant only as a means to be misal what you want to be misal. It's a means to give you a sense of what is prayer worthy. What should a Jew always be being misal for? So that's why I think it's important, and that's why that person, I can't speak for someone, didn't hear what the person said, but that's why I can understand somebody wants to de-emphasize those personal tefillahs, so that you begin to get a feel for what Eishek HaSek Dolo put into tefillah. That I could understand. Yes, what's your name?
Tyler Spiro from Long Island. How are
Long Island, speak. Which title?
Sayasit.
Okay.
Right.
Yes,
that's why I said
what?
I never heard of it either.
So, how
that's
because
he's from Baltimore.
Silver.
I'll ask Bechila later, okay? It's fine. Yeah.
How should someone practically make a Kabbalah on Shemaim?
So, I believe that for us, when it's personal, it's much easier. The sense for us, Kabbalah on Shemaim means that our life is dedicated to bringing out something Kadosh Baruch Hu wants to bring out in this world. Our entire life is that. That's why we're here for. Everything we were given in terms of talents, abilities, assets, etc. And, you know, it's much easier to become Kabbalah Shemaim in the whole world than on yourself. And I think if we would focus and think a moment or two, it means that whatever I have I was given a kit to construct something of Kvod Shemayim. And whatever abilities I have, that it's all focused for that. Now, the Rambam says, and the Rambam says in Shmona Prokim, that there can mean 1,000 activities. I could be taking a day off on the beach, because if I take a day off on the beach, I'll be able to work more relaxed, and I'll be able to earn what I need to eat, and so on, much more quickly, much more efficiently, and then I'll have more time and more nefesh to spend in doing the core things I was created for. All of life includes billions of different pieces. The Rambam says our job is to align them all at Echad. If Hashem is Echad, then the purpose of my existence is Echad. And which means I have to be able to justify whatever I do in terms of the goal. And that's what Hashem Echad implies in us personally. Yeah, what's your name?
Menachem Benemu from Eben Shoya.
There's a Benemu in Silver Spring? Any relationship?
Not at all.
So you're from where again?
Melbourne, Australia.
Melbourne, yeah.
So my question is about, let's say, like learning and working. How to, like in like day-to-day life after Yeshiva, whenever that is, how to, I guess, you know, how much is, you know, enough to be like learning and working and...
So in my days, they would have said, now a word from our sponsor. I wrote a book on it that just came out, and you can buy it in this place, and it'll tell you everything you need to know, and you're all set for life.
Yeah,
what?
Yeah, yeah.
You have it here, okay.
We actually wanted to get an autograph.
I should have mentioned it. It's something that is the struggle. It's the positive struggle of a yeshiva person. If and when you leave yeshiva, you're struggling with it, that itself is the first point. And the hard part is retaining what we spoke about just now. When I make a chesed nefesh, what should I go to work at? So I need to take stock of what I can do, what's my ability, am I good at work, am I good at office work, am I good at arguing case, you know, what would be my talents, that's one, what I need for Parnassa, and what will give me the best deal in Ruchnius, what will put me in an environment that's least problematic, what will afford me quality time to be with the family, to learn, to daven like I mentioned, so on. As long as a person understands that, the problem is if our primary motive in a career is the glory of the career, that's one thing everyone says he's a high-powered attorney, then I'm going to shove everything else into a corner and compromise on it. If my thing is money, then the business that makes the most money may be the most challenging in terms of Yiddishkeit. It may take every waking hour of my day plus night hours. And the question is it, what is my tachlis? And a person needs to honestly keep asking himself that and speaking over with a Rebbe or somebody. That's the first step in many, many other steps. But that step, I think, is the most important step. Yeah. What else? When is Shkia, first of all? I've mincha challenged. 527. What? 527. You done mincha ready?
Yeah.
What?
It's another minion.
What time do you know?
5:15.
Okay, so I'm gonna have to be there at 5:15, and okay, so we have another 10 minutes, and yeah, okay. Yes.
So, when like the Gemara says something, right, and it doesn't like go well with like modern day science, kind of like, or just common sense, like I don't know, like stuff like the eye is like, you know, the most intricate part, like the most complex part of the human body, or there's like four rivers that connect like in the world like by each corner and stuff, like just stuff that just doesn't work, like how are you supposed to?
So it's a big topic. I'll tell you the approach that the Maral has in the Sefer Be'er HaGola. The Maral wrote an immense amount of Svarim, and the Maral's point was to explain Agadata correctly. His basic premise was, the Gemara is very big, and the Gemara's purpose is to teach us Torah, not science, not physics, not anything. When Chazal digress into Agadata about things that seem to have no bearing on Torah, they're teaching us Torah through using the commonly understood features of the Bria. So none of these Gemaras are meant for the literal purpose, because why would Chazal tell us how to cure ailments? That belongs in a medical book, doesn't belong. You have to understand the Gemara, they tried to make the Gemara because people couldn't memorize all the material. They wrote it down as a heter of Esas Hashem. They tried to make it as brief as possible, because the more brief you can make it, the more people, the less it's liable to be forgotten, the easier to carry it around, and so on. So the Maral says Chazal was speaking more about the physical, about the conceptual reality than physical reality. Let me give you an example of what I would mean. Maral is almost every Chazal is like that. He speaks the Mashal. Let's say Chazal, something. It says Adam HaRishon was created in the first hour. HaKadosh Baruch Hu prepared the earth. In the second hour, he mixed it with water. The third hour, he made a golem out of it. The next hour, he breathed life. Then he stood erect. Then he got married. They had two children, and all within 12 hours. What is Chazal telling us? What is that timetable about? So each point in it is telling me a concept. Why? What are the different layers of what make Adam? It's not meant to tell you a literal timetable. Mm-hmm. It's meant to explain structurally. So the Maral says every single point Chazal has to be understood. What is the point Chazal bringing out? Agadata is Torah that's spoken in a metaphor. Let me give you an example of something, not a Agadata, but something we could imagine. We go to see a play. And this play is a very, very powerful, impressive play. And we're sitting, and because of two princes fighting, one of them burns the entire city down. Men, women, children, everything. and the play ends with devastation. And you're shaken, and you turn to your guy and say, you know, take a look what jealousy does. It absolutely destroys an entire country. And he said, what are you talking about? It wasn't real fire. Didn't you see there was these lights going up and down, and then the stage went down and down? So he said, one second. You're talking about the technician in the back. I'm talking about the play that was presented to me. Mm-hmm. Chazal speak with pictures. It's so much more powerful when you say, other missions stood erect. That means something. It means his head turned on top of his body and began to control his surroundings. Adam Marisha was Mischaba to Chava. That's the final stage in Adam Shlemus. Why was it 12 hours? So Maral says, 12 hours is the entire compass of day. Just like man is everywhere in the world, he's all present time. So all any Agadata that is talking about things that are off, it means these are words and pictures used to describe something deeper. The Maral is the most powerful mefarish on this. The Goyen is much more cryptic. It's hard to understand the Goyen. The Goyen also says this. The Goyen says he says on a certain pasuk, it says about there's a perek and gimel in Yeshaya about Mashiach, Melech Mashiach, that his face is terribly distorted, like grotesque. And Hoyde Moshchas. So he says that this is referring to the Chalokim of Torah who are presented to us in ways that turn people off, like the Agadatas in Baba Basra. There's a sugya of Rabbi Hana, they were traveling on these oceans and they saw these monsters, crazy things. The Goyen says these are the deepest concepts in Torah, and for whatever reason Chazal chose it to tell us it in stories that really any causal reader would be kind of, any intelligent causal reader would be turned back. And he says it's part of the chisaron of Torah, whatever reason he gives. He says just like the Perek describes that Melech Mashiach at first will seem to us misshapen, grotesque, turn off, so too these chalakim of Torah are like that. So it wherever you see a chazal that on pshat level it seems kind of strange, it has depth to it. The Maral is a great sefer, not an easy sefer always, and the Ben Yishchai actually is also extremely good. He wrote it's called Yayada, Benayahu. He has two sfarim that are major. Most of it is explaining that.
It's pretty meta to explain it.
What?
It's pretty meta to explain it like through a parable about the parables.
We call it a parable squared.
Ah,
a parabola.
It's infinite in what it can mean.
But you know what? You can convey so much more through a story, and it's so much more powerful when you convey something in a story. I'll finish with one more. The Balatanya, who lived in Russia at a time when Russia was always not an easy country for Jews. The Tsar was not particularly nice. He wanted to make a decree driving Jews out of certain towns. So when he made the Pale, where Jews were driven out into a small settlement, and it meant many people dislodged, had no parnasa, it was very, very destructive. And about time they went to try to dissuade him, and they had an argument, and he said that your Talmud is full of lies and exaggerations. It says there's a Gemara about a bird that came and dropped something and destroyed an entire island, etc. So Batanya said to him, my dear Tsar, your eminence, future historians will say that with one drop of ink, the Tsar drowned 100,000 Jews. Will that be an exaggeration or the truth? In other words, you're signing the decree is a destruction. So it's so much more powerful when you say it that way. And Chazal had these, and that's why Agadatas are striking, because they're very vivid pictures. So we need to understand what those pictures mean, but they spoke with a mashal. The wisest of men wrote a book of his wisdom. He called it Mishlei. He called it the book of metaphors. Because real wisdom is given best in a metaphor rather than a philosophical form. And therefore, the whole Sefer Mishlei deals about a woman that's not faithful, a man that goes away, and it's all talking about something else. Okay, I'm sorry, I have to go. See, the Olam is a very, very intelligent, engaged Olam, but I've... Okay, Seder.